thank you so much, Ellie, for being with me today on the Wave Capital's guest speaker series on relationship building in a team environment. You're my 80th guest. How are you today, Ellie?
Good. Thanks for having me. I guess 80, let's hope it's an auspicious number.
Yes.
Jerry Rice is 80, right? I see the football stuff behind you.
Yes, Jerry Rice is number 80.
We'll try to keep his level of excellence in mind then.
Sure, absolutely. Yes, 80 is a milestone podcast for the speaker series. And yeah, speaking of Jerry Rice, I did meet him when I worked at ESPN many years ago. When you think of relationship building in a team environment, what does it mean to you and what has it meant for your professional career?
I think it's an important aspect of what we do. It's part of it is just common sense. Just, you know, be decent to people, be responsive. You know, TV and media are competitive environments, and you can stand out with just a bit of basic courtesy. Like, I'll give you a couple examples. I always tell people when they're starting, if you get an email from a booker, respond. Like, if you can do the segment, great. You know, you should be happy they're reaching out to you. But if you can't, don't just ignore them. I'm friends with bookers. They tell me, you know how it makes them nuts when they send someone an email and the person doesn't respond at all, how inconsiderate that is. And then, you know, every time I can, which is most of the time, if time permits, at least send a couple quick notes, at least give the producer of the segment a call. Hey, which points do you want to hit? Here's what I think is important. That type of little extra effort, A, makes you better, gives you better segments, and B, you help other people do their jobs and they help you do your job. So it takes a little extra work. It takes a little extra consideration, but I think that type of approach is transferable to all sorts of different industries.
Absolutely. And you're a Rutgers graduate. You went to Harvard Law School. In your early days and early part of life, what inspired you? Any mentors of yours you looked up to? But what inspired you to follow the legal route, you know, pursuing a degree in law and pursuing a career that pertains to the criminal justice system?
So it's a little cliche, but obviously my dad we don't get corny in my family, but my dad was a lawyer. He retired now, but it's not in the way you think. I think people go, oh, your dad was a lawyer. You must have seen that and thought, I want to do that. It's actually kind of the opposite, because my dad worked his ass off and it was a grind. He did well, but I was under no illusions about what the law is, right? I think a lot of people, you know, went into law school having seen A Few Good Men and thought, that's what I'm going to be doing. You know, I knew what it really entailed. My dad had a small practice. He was either solo or he had a couple people here and there who were associates and partners. But I used to go in and it's hard work and it's unforgiving. And I would help him when I was a kid, when I was 10 or 11, you know, move file boxes around and that kind of thing. My first ever paid job was when he had one of these offices in like the suburbs in a house that was zoned for business, and it would flood, the basement flooded. And so I came in and I spent 2 full days. When it flooded, pulling boxes out and like reshuffling them and putting all the files back in place and everything. So I guess I mean that to say, I understood the value of hard work from my dad, but I went into the law with a very clear vision of what it meant to really practice. And, you know, when I was in law school, I knew I wanted to, A, practice law. By the way, not everyone at law school wants to practice law. Like, a lot of people are like, I just want to go, at the time, I want to go into .coms. Now I'm sure it's, you know, venture capital or finance. And even people who did want to practice law, a lot of them wanted to be corporate side. I knew I wanted to be litigator in the courtroom. And my sort of ultimate job that I had in mind was becoming a prosecutor, ideally with DOJ, which is something I was lucky to do. This whole media thing was never part of the plan. That just happened sort of the way that the chips fell. So, but I do love being a prosecutor and I love what I'm doing now in different ways, but equally, or maybe even more now. I don't know.
Yes, absolutely. That's such a great answer. And thank you so much for walking me through all that. And, you know, Jeffrey Toobin, also a Harvard Law School graduate. A lot of Ivy Leaguers, they pursue law and they're known to be in the tops of their profession. But for someone like you, you end up in media, which is wonderful. And CNN is, I'm sure, very lucky to have you and welcomes all of your opinions, thoughts. I certainly have taken a liking to your analysis on CNN, an avid CNN watcher. I know some people personally at the network and who have also been a graduate of my journalism school at the UNC Husband School of Journalism and Media. But you were also the assistant U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York. Talk to me about those years being the assistant U.S. attorney and really how it shaped the rest of your career. Would you consider that to be a pivotal moment in your career?
Oh, sure. So a couple of things. First of all, you know, you said something like Ivy Leaguers. Like, yes, I went to Harvard Law, but I went to Rutgers College. I went to my state university. I never went to a private school until Harvard Law. I mean, I went to public K to 12, public college. So I take pride in that. It's weird that I guess that I'm pushing back against being lumped in as an Ivy Leaguer, but alas. Be clear, I was an assistant U.S. attorney. I wasn't like number two or anything in the office. You know, you have each of these offices has a U.S. attorney. And then in the SDNY, we had maybe 150 criminal prosecutors at a time. I was one of those 150. And it's the dream job. If you want to be a real lawyer, a courtroom lawyer, you're in court every day. You're trying cases. I ended up becoming the chief of organized crime unit. And I did things that were out of a movie better than a movie, but real life. I tried bosses, capos on racketeering, murder, four or five guys at a time, flipped guys. I mean, you have wild adventures beyond what you could. I mean, there were many moments when I would just think, I can't believe this is real. I can't believe I'm sitting in a maximum security prison talking to a murderer trying to flip him. I can't believe I'm about to get a jury verdict on whether this boss is guilty of racketeering and murder. You know, I mean, I can't believe I'm about to argue a case in front of the Second Circuit. And so it's sort of like somebody wrote a piece a few years ago, I forget if it was maybe the New Yorker, where they called the SDNY like ninja school for lawyers. Yeah. Like, you know, you go to get your advanced degree in it. And there is something to that. So it's just a great, great job. And because you're doing important work, like you're not making as much money as your colleagues who are in firms. Most of us go to the SDNY from firms. That's what I did. And so you take a pay cut, but it's more than worth it.
Yes. And when you were having to try cases and being in a courtroom with, you know, people who have committed serious crimes and being a part of the mafia, was that intimidating? Not from the standpoint of being afraid, but was it intimidating knowing that you're sharing the courtroom with some of the most hardened criminals that this country's ever seen?
A trial itself is terrifying. I mean, you know, how many professions are there where you work around the clock for months getting ready for something, you battle it out, and then there's someone declared a winner and a loser, right? I mean, maybe boxing, UFC, and this, right? And so you're so invested and you've worked so hard and the stakes at trial are so high and it's so unpredictable that, you know, your stress hormones are on full blast the whole time. I never, ever felt personally afraid or threatened of any gangster, anyone. You know, there's a lot of reasons for that, but one of them is it's against the mob rules to try to do anything to a prosecutor or a cop or a judge. They break their own rules all the time, for sure. But this one, they really do pretty much observe. There have been isolated instances dating back many years, but it wouldn't make any sense for them to do anything to me. Also, like, I never made it personal with these guys. I mean, I respected the process. They knew what I was there to be a pro. I was there to win the case, but I didn't feel any particular need to humiliate anyone or make them suffer beyond the consequences of a conviction. So I wasn't the type. Someone told me once early on, you know, you got to get in that defendant's face and point your finger and say, this sleazebag. That wasn't my style. I didn't need it. It didn't work. It worked better to just treat people with respect, even if they're defendants, and to do your job in a businesslike manner. So that's always how I approach it. So no, never got threatened, never scared. The person who's more likely to do something isn't necessarily like the hardened gangster killer. It's going to be the guy who's maybe a little bit off, who you had in some tiny case that you forgot about your first year. That's a little more nerve-wracking, I think.
Sure, that makes perfect sense. Somebody you would least expect is typically the one who could be the problem, or somebody you don't hear much of or much from. When I was talking to both your colleagues at CNN, Jeffrey Toobin and Joey Jackson, also both members of the legal community, they were talking to me about specific cases that were very memorable to them, where they felt like they learned so much from. Are there any cases, Ellie, that come to mind where you're like, I'm really prideful that I won that case?
Well, I mean, you take pride in all your cases. I did a bunch of mob cases, which are like stuff out of movies. But the one that I remember that I'm, I guess, most proud of now is a human trafficking case that came to me when it was in my second or third year at the office. No one wanted to do it. And I know that because the agent who put this case together had been kicked from one AUSA to another. You know, AUSAs are really good. When we don't want to do a case, we find any excuse. Oh, I need to reassign it. Sorry, I can't. And so I was maybe the third or fourth even AUSA to get this case. So that's always a sure sign that there's, you know, it's a mess. And it turned out that we made a case against 30 plus, I think it was 30, 33, 34 defendants who were running a massive human trafficking ring. What they were doing is they were smuggling women in from South Korea illegally. They were telling these women, young women, not underage, but, you know, 20, 22, 24. They were telling these women, we will get you into the, this is 15 years ago. We will get you into the United States and you will then owe us $10,000, which you will work off by being working in a restaurant or bussing tables or working in a hotel or something like that. When the women got here and they would smuggle them in through all different ways, the deal would be changed on them, right? Because they have no power. What are they going to do? And suddenly the $10,000 that they owed, they were told, would be now $30,000. And by the way, the smugglers would tell them, we're not going to wait for you to make, you know, $50 a night waiting tables. You're going to work as a sex worker. And so these women were essentially kept in bondage, more or less, at times physically, at other times like locked in basements and boiler rooms. And they were made to work in this series of brothels, basically, throughout the United States, really stretching. We took down, in this case, I think we went as far south as Maryland or Virginia, North Carolina, actually, and as far north as Rhode Island. So we hit 14 of these spots in one day. We recovered 70 victims, 70 women, all of whom were being, you know, abused, sexually abused, restrained, that kind of thing. And we ended up trying a whole bunch, you know, a bunch of the people pled guilty. We tried five of them at once and convicted all of them. And that was a difficult case, but it also, it was not a cookie cutter case. Like so much of what you do as a prosecutor, if you're doing an armed robbery case, the guy next door definitely has an armed robbery indictment. You can just copy and paste. This was, we didn't know we were doing. I mean, nobody had charged this kind of thing at the time. And it was a huge case and it was incredibly difficult. Everything had to go through interpreters because it was all spoken in Korean. And, you know, we found and saved 70 victims. So that's one that I'm proud of.
And because of what you had to endure to win that case and to, you know, put people behind bars, I mean, I'm sure it was gratifying and relieving. And also you saved a lot of innocent women's lives.
Yeah. I mean, I will say though, yes, thank you. But, you know, some of the women were not thrilled. I mean, some of them were scared that they were in trouble when we came in, right? They see law enforcement, they know. And some of them wanted to go home. You know, some of them just said, I don't want to testify in your trial. I don't want to testify against these people who I know. Just send me home. And so we had to sort of sort through them and figure out who we could send home and who we still needed as a witness. We tried, you know, we honored their wishes to the best of our ability. But yeah, you do have a real impact in a tangible way on people's lives. Like the murder cases I did, I mean, the families are usually there, you know, the families of the victim. And this is their only chance to get some sort of accountability and justice for what was done.
Sure. Well, thank you for sharing that with me. And I'm sure it was a very emotional case to work on, but because of you, it made a difference in, you know, that coming to a conclusion and breaking all of that criminal related activity up and then, and again, saving those women's lives.
Thanks.
When you think of the books you've written, and I know that your book is coming out this September, When You Come at the King, and talking about and highlighting from President Nixon to President Trump, talk me about that book, how many hours or how much research you had to do to get that book into successful distribution and soon to be on everybody's, you know, hopefully coffee tables and side tables and buying in bookstores. So tell me about that book and your previous books that you've written, because it's not your first book.
Yeah, this is my third book with HarperCollins. And I will say, because I know this is about sort of thriving in a team environment, same team basically every time. I have never had a book. Well, I briefly had a book agent, but it didn't really go anywhere. All of this happened without any agents involved. Eric Nelson, who's my editor at HarperCollins, DM'd me on Twitter in 2020. I never met him. He saw me on TV and he DM me. It's something like, I quote it in the acknowledgments of this book. It was something like, hey, would you be interested in writing a book about Bill Barr, which was my first book? And I figured out who he was. He's an editor for a lot of people who write books in this space. And I said, yep. And a couple of days later, we talked on the phone. And a couple of days after that, we had a deal. And 5 years later, we now have our third book. It's a small team. You know, everyone has different processes when they write. I like to get all my thoughts, just get them out on paper or on the screen and then craft, edit till it's sharp. And that's how I do even my short form pieces for New York Magazine. I worked with a very small team. Eric edited me, but he barely touches what I write. All he does is encourage me, give me very, very broad guidance, but he won't line edit it. There's people at Harper who will fly spec it and that kind of thing. I hired a team of three researchers and one fact checker. You have to do that on your own. I hired two young recent college grads who work at CNN, another one who I taught at Rutgers, who's now at Harvard Law, same as I was. And then I used a fact checker from CNN who I paid separately to do it, you know, outside of work hours. And so it's this very small team of four or five people putting this massive piece of work together. This book here was the most fun to research and write because what I did in this book is I interviewed firsthand participants, 35 or so people who were actually involved in these cases as far back as Watergate, all the way up to Jack Smith, which just ended, you know, last year. Getting to hear their first person perspectives, which are in the book, about controversial moments, about dramatic moments. What was it like defending the president? What was it like when you questioned the president? What was it like when you were tried? I talked to a couple people who were put on trial by special counsel. What was it like, you know, working in the White House when this happened? What was it like in the trial room, in the deposition room? And there's so many examples of that. And so when I would do these interviews, the book would almost take shape around what they were telling me. I mean, you know, in the beginning, the end, I have sort of big picture analysis and I have tons of historical stuff in there, but it's really like each chapter stands alone as the inside story of whether it's Watergate, Iran-Contra, Bill Clinton and Ken Starr, all the way up through Mueller and Robert Hur with Joe Biden and the Hunter Biden cases and Jack Smith. And every one of these people, where we got the title from, when you come at the king, I mean, you probably know if you watch The Wire, right? It's a famous line from Omar, when you come at the king, you best not miss. But that goes back to Machiavelli. That's an ancient saying. And it hit me when I was researching this because every one of these folks, no matter what, whether they're a prosecutor, defense lawyer, defendant, witness, whatever, judge, all realized that this would be the highest stakes battle they'd ever have and that it would be the main thing or maybe the only thing they'd be remembered for. And when you get people in that type of life or death, you know, professional and political life or death situation, sometimes it brings out the best and sometimes it brings out the worst in people. So the stories in here, I'm so proud of. I loved hearing and I love retelling them. I'll give you some, you know, there's a million of them, but I'm sure we'll hit on a couple favorites.
Sure. And, you know, thank you for that rendition for my audience and me of, you know, and when I say rendition, it's the rendition because you wrote the book and you're going to be able to give better than anybody the best summary of all the different cases and all the different elements of our country's history when it comes to the presidents that we've had and all of the big monumental developments from Watergate to present day. And I remember watching, especially the last couple of years with your CNN coverage with respect to Jack Smith and all of the different cases that were brought against, well, former President Trump during the 4 years that President Biden was in office. Questions I asked Jeffrey, questions I asked Joey, how much confidence do you have in the American justice system, especially in the last 10 years, you know, given that now we have a 6-3 Supreme Court in favor of Republicans because it's 6-3 conservative majority, but given the fact that we have the Make America Great Again movement in the Republican Party that's redefined the Republican Party with President Trump, you know, being the leader of the party, how concerned are you about democracy and our Constitution and the foundational principles being not shattered, but given just everything going on, you know, the future and how it can all hold up?
The courts are not perfect. The justice system is not perfect. Neither of them ever have or could be. I do believe in those structures and institutions. I do not think our democracy is about to end. I know people, look, I'm not a huge political fan of Donald Trump, but I also don't buy into the notion that he's going to end our democracy, as so many people have been saying. I mean, he's in year five now of his presidency, obviously with the 4 year gap, and we still exist. We're fine. He absolutely is pushing outer limits. He is testing boundaries, but I think the courts have by and large done a good job. I don't agree with every decision, but I think they've done a good job of drawing lines and of reining him in. But one of the arguments I make in this piece is that so many safeguards have been kicked down by Donald Trump, including there's no possibility that there will be any sort of independent prosecution into Trump or the administration during this term. I mean, it's a miracle that Mueller happened last term, and I think he has learned from that. And not only that, it appears Trump is gearing up to weaponize DOJ. And look, I think there was weaponization against him as well, to an extent. I think Letitia James, for example, absolutely weaponized her political office. Alvin Bragg, who I've known forever, absolutely brought a ridiculous case against Trump. I don't think that justifies him doing the same thing to others. And so what I argue in the book is Trump is kicking down a lot of guardrails. And the question for whoever comes next and after that, Democrat or Republican, is going to be which of those, if any, do we restore? And it's going to be tempting for whoever comes next to say, you know, there's so many, I mean, whistleblower protections and inspectors general and ethics laws. It's going to be tempting for the next president to go, why would I bring that back? All that can do is make life difficult for me. And I argue in this book that whatever we call them, and we've called them different names over history, independent prosecutor, now special counsel, that notion of having some sort of independent prosecutor capable of investigating the president as top brass, that cannot be discarded for all time. It's been imperfect, as I lay out in the book. There have been investigations that have gone bad, but I suggest in the book ways we can do better. But that has to come back. Otherwise, we're going to lose a really crucial check on the presidency.
Sure. And I would imagine that what could have prevented Donald Trump's second term is that if Merrick Garland had, you know, the attorney general, obviously under President Biden, or former mm-hmm. President Biden now, but if Merrick Garland had identified Jack Smith to be special counsel probably a lot sooner.
You know, President Biden, it's an unanswerable counterfactual. Yeah. And I consider it in the book. I mean, I definitely critique Merrick Garland for taking that long, right? He didn't mm-hmm. put Jack Smith in place until nearly 2 years into his term. Jack Smith, you know, he moved quickly, but I argue in the book, he never had a chance. I mean, anyone who understands federal courts and federal criminal litigation could have told you there's no way Jack Smith's going to be able to get this case fully investigated, indicted, and tried before the election, especially given the lingering immunity issue. So I do think Merrick Garland is to blame for the fact that Jack Smith was not able to try his cases before the election. I don't know, and I don't know that we will ever know, whether it would have changed the election had he done so. I mean, look, A, we don't know what the outcome would have been. We don't know whether Trump would have been convicted. It could be that a jury would have hung or he would have been acquitted, which would have been probably rocket fuel for him. The Alvin Bragg case was tried and he was convicted. And if anything, I think it rebounded against Alvin Bragg and in Trump's favor. I mean, a lot of people who really understand what they're talking about in this political side of the world say that that onslaught of charges on Trump was really what spurred him certainly to the Republican nomination, which he then won from. So I think it's absolutely fair to lay fault at the feet of Merrick Garland. But I don't know that had he moved quicker, it would have changed the election. Nobody will ever know whether that would have changed the election result.
Sure. And those are all valid points, Ali. I really appreciate you sharing that for my audience and me at home. Because when I think of, you know, the election subversion case in Georgia, the classified documents, President Trump willfully withholding those documents, January 6th, and then obviously you mentioned Alvin Bragg's case in New York. Because President Trump pardoned over 1,500 January 6th insurrectionists, it's very damning that January 6th had to be dismissed and that that case did not reach its full conclusion. I mean, the case in Georgia, classified documents case, also really upsetting that those cases did not, you know, reach full conclusion. But when you have something like January 6th, the heinous criminal acts, attacking police officers, charging through the Capitol, damaging, really attacking the symbol of democracy, our nation's capital. From a legal perspective, and when historians look back 20, 50, 100 years from now, will that also define, it may sound like a rhetorical question, but I think I know what your answer is going to be, will that define the Trump presidency that we actually had a president in U.S. history pardon over 1,500 criminals from January 6th, and that Jack Smith was not able to conclude his work?
Oh, sure. I mean, I think the pardons of January 6th rioters were historic disgraces, and I don't think they will age well in history. I don't think they aged well right away. Even Trump's defenders are sort of always on their heels to explain that. I don't think any January 6th pardon would have been warranted, but at a minimum, he could have separated the violent from the nonviolent offenders. But I don't think that he will ever be able to explain that. You know, I talked to Donald Trump's lawyers for this book. I also talked to lawyers for Hunter Biden, Joe Biden. I talked to prosecutors on various teams. The lawyers for Trump make a case in the book, though, that Jack Smith went, and I think there's some fairness to this. There's no denying Jack Smith was in a mad dash to get his case tried before the election, right? I mean, nobody can, in good faith, say he didn't care about getting it in before the election, yet he wouldn't ever admit that that was his motivation in court. But some of the things Jack Smith asked the court to do, I think, were unfair and probably unconstitutional. I'll give you an example. He indicted his case in the summer, I want to say August of 2023. And he asked the court to hold a trial 5 months later in January of 2024. That's ridiculous. This is a 13 million page case of discovery. The defense is entitled to go through the discovery. There's no physical way they could have ever gone through all that discovery in time. And Jack Smith didn't care. The average case in DC, federal felony case, run-of-the-mill case, guns, drugs, whatever, the defendant gets 28 months, 2 years and 4 months to prepare for trial. Yet Donald Trump, in an extraordinarily complicated case, according to Jack Smith, should have been given 5 months. That's outrageous. And, you know, I sort of fault Smith, but I also, he was in a no-win situation. I mean, if he had played this according to the normal clock, he would have had no chance to try Trump before the election. As it ended up, he didn't get it done anyway. But I think there are valid criticisms of Jack Smith, and that's one of them. You know, some of his team expressed, look, they believed in the guy, but Abby Lowell, who is a well-known, primarily Democratic power lawyer, he represented Hunter Biden, although he's had a few Republican clients, but he's largely represented Democratic interests over the year. He was critical of Smith in the book. And this is no Republican, and this is God knows no Trump fan, but he had done cases earlier with Jack Smith, and he said, look, the guy's a guided missile, and he's zealous, maybe, I'm paraphrasing here, maybe overzealous to a point that may have backfired on him. And Trump's lawyer said to me, while we disagreed with everything the guy did, he was the best possible person who could have reinvigorated Trump's campaign. The Trump lawyer says they couldn't have picked a better guy if they put Darth Vader in as the prosecutor, because he was a fire breather and he was full of brimstone and he overdid it. And there's an account in the book of what happened when Trump's lawyers went in to meet with Jack Smith's lawyers just days before the indictment. And it's kind of ugly what went down between them.
Yeah. And it's, like you said, it was a no-win situation.
By the way, Jack Smith declined to speak with me for the book. Understandable.
Oh, he did.
I should add, I mean, as much as I have been critical of Jack Smith, I think Trump's current efforts to investigate Jack Smith are ridiculous and dangerous. I mean, we can critique Jack Smith's performance as a prosecutor. That guy didn't do anything criminal, certainly not that I've ever seen or am aware of. And the fact that they're now weaponizing DOJ to go after him and others, Letitia James, who I largely disagree with, but this is weaponization as well, maybe even worse, because you're going after prosecutors who are trying to do their jobs.
Are you shocked that he declined?
You mean Jack Smith?
Yeah.
He declined to talk to me for the book. No, because he has, I mean, in part because he hasn't ever talked to anybody in public, you know, in the media that I know of. He's never done an interview with 60 Minutes or anything like that. B, he has legal jeopardy. I mean, he's now being investigated for ethics violations. He's being investigated by DOJ. So if I was his lawyer, I would tell him, no, you're not talking to anyone in public. So no, I don't fault him for that, but I certainly had to give him the opportunity.
Sure, of course. And talk to me about your previous books, because you had also wrote a book about former Attorney General Bill Barr. And obviously him and Jeff Sessions were the two attorney generals during Trump's first term.
Yeah.
How much did you learn writing about Bill Barr, and what were things he could have done differently or to try to stop some of the things that Trump ultimately did in his first term?
So the first book is very critical of Bill Barr. It's called Hatchet Man, How Bill Barr Broke the Prosecutor's Code and Corrupted the Justice Department. Although now he seems less bad in retrospect, given some of what we're seeing from Pam Bondi. You know, Bill Barr was a dishonest, politically motivated operator. He, for example, most famously distorted the findings in Mueller's report. Rather than issue the summaries Mueller had prepared, Bill Barr put out a highly distorted 4-page summary. By the way, I talked to those prosecutors from Mueller's team who were still to this day furious and feel like Barr betrayed them and misrepresented their case. And Barr, you know, helped to protect Trump's flank at every turn. Barr ultimately broke from Trump on the issue of whether the 2020 election was stolen. And when Barr said publicly it was not, that's when Barr was essentially shoved out the door. And, you know, Barr's since become a sort of complicated figure because he is critical of Trump at certain points, but at other points he has continued to defend him. But I think Barr really started us. Look, no AG's been perfect, but Barr, I think, really politicized that office and use it to protect Trump in often dishonest ways that I think are really astonishing when you look at it. I mean, Bill Barr's dishonesty, I'll give you a very small example of how Bill Barr, I say in the book, the guy's a liar, and he is. I mean, here's an example. So after Mueller sends his report to Barr, Barr issues this, what we now know to be distorted 4-page summary. Mueller then sends Barr a letter, which we've now seen, by the time we didn't know of it, saying, you have misstated my work and my conclusions. Barr then goes in front of Congress. Now, Barr has gotten this letter from Mueller saying, you have misstated my conclusions. And a member of Congress asks Barr, has anyone on Mueller's team expressed any dissatisfaction to you? And Barr says, no, when he had already received this letter from Mueller saying just that. And later on, he was asked about that at a later congressional session. And the congressman says, you lied to us. You told us you hadn't received a letter when you had. And he just goes in this like mush mouth word salad of how it wasn't a lie. So he really was just sort of all about protecting. I don't think Bill Barr had any particular affinity for Donald Trump, the individual, but I think Bill Barr felt strongly that his role as AG was to protect the president. And he was willing to bend the truth in order to do that.
And what we're seeing with now Attorney General Pam Bondi, just seems...
Well, it's worse.
Yeah.
Bill Barr was never willing to use the power of the attorney general's job. He definitely was willing to use it defensively to protect Trump, but he was never willing to use it to go after people, to prosecute enemies. In fact, he declined to do so a couple times. Trump wanted him to go after John Kerry. He wouldn't do it. Trump wanted him to go after Hunter Biden, which he did, but they didn't leak it. Trump was pissed that when he found out later that Barr hadn't leaked it. What Bondi is doing is A, refusing to look at anything that might harm Trump, and B, like aggressively going after anyone who's deemed a political adversary. So I think what Bondi's doing is worse and more dangerous.
And with Jeffrey Epstein and, you know, you on CNN were explaining the grand jury minutes that's only a fraction of how much data or information is out there. So I know that this is ongoing and that people are being subpoenaed of Democrats and Republicans alike to discuss, you know, what they know. Just from your perspective, will the Jeffrey Epstein files and people are believing that Donald Trump is named in those files? I think a lot of his supporters, you know, MAGA and you know, Republicans, they want to know the truth because whether it's Cash Patel or whether it's Dan Bongino considered to be, you know, conspiracy theorists, if you will, on this subject matter. What are your thoughts on how this is all going to shake out and will some conclusion be, you know, discovered?
I don't know that we'll ever get to a point where people say, okay, I accept this to be the case with Epstein. I think we're almost at a point where there's so many theories out there and people are so dug in that I don't know that people are ever going to be talked out of what they believe. I do think we'll see the documents. We have reporting that, well, we know Congress has subpoenaed the documents and apparently DOJ has said they're going to comply within the next few days. They're going to start turning over documents. So I do think we'll see that. You know, there's been wide reporting that Trump is named in the Epstein files, but just being named in the Epstein files doesn't mean he committed a crime. Bill Barr, speaking of, just testified in Congress yesterday, and apparently, you know, he was AG during part of this. He says that there's no mention of Trump doing anything criminal. So it could well be that that's how it plays out. I'm sure there are mentions of various other people doing criminal things and having sexual contact with minors. Will we find out who those people are? I just don't know. But I do think we're going to see many of the Epstein files fairly quickly. And I think ultimately, if I had to guess, I would guess it's sort of anticlimactic. Like by all appearances, there's not some client list that just says, here's everyone who ever had sex with minors. I think there may be other, you know, there may be smatterings of information like that scattered throughout the files, but I don't think it's as neat and tidy as here's a client list.
Sure. That makes sense. And also it gives my audience and me at home just some extra detail because what we hear on CNN, whether it's you or others in the legal community talking about the subject matter, it's nice that you can clarify and you can offer your perspectives on this. And, you know, it's very sensitive information and it's very upsetting that there were a lot of women who were innocently targeted and abused and hurt in all of this. And families obviously want justice to be served. And I really hope that for the sake of the families and the victims who had to endure all of this, that there is a conclusion to be had. Mm-hmm. When you think of your time at CNN, and it's been quite a number of years, how much do you love your CNN community, your family at CNN, and getting to work with wonderful people every day?
So none of this, again, was ever the plan or expected. I didn't go to journalism school. I started doing this in the summer of 2018 because the Mueller investigation was happening, and they just needed people all day, every day. So I had friends from the Southern District who had left the SDNY who were doing it and said, would you want to try it? I said, yeah. I mean, I thought it was looked fun and it looked consistent with what I was doing. I was teaching at Rutgers and it just took off from there. I love this job. I love the CNN part of it. I love the writing of books. I love writing for New York Magazine. The CNN family, I mean, man, it truly, it's cliche to say, but it really is a family. I mean, you're in this together. Like, you have to figure these things out on the fly. It all works together. And I always go out of my way to be friends with and talk to everyone, whether it's the guys on the stage, the makeup people, the sound people, the engineers, the people who run our digital stuff, our website. Like, it's such a complicated, multifaceted machine. To be part of it is a privilege. You have to work your ass off. The hours are insane. I don't mean like the hours, if you add them all up, I mean, they're a lot, but like, you know, I'll have days where I wake up at 5:30 in the morning and I'm on at 7, and then I'm on at 11, and then I'm on at 4, and then I'm on at 9 p.m., you know, and I'm home at 10:30. So it's like the hours are strange and it's unpredictable. You never know when the phone's going to ring and something. Where are you? How quick can you get in front of a camera? But it's a thrill to be able to explain this stuff to a national or international audience, and to get to help them understand. That to me is the highest value I can bring, to make this stuff understandable and interesting to normal people. I mean, that's who watches us, normal people. Yes, politicians watch us and all that, but by and large, it's normal people who care about this world. And it's a privilege to do it. And you can't ever, I never take any appearance for granted. I mean, I think it was Joe DiMaggio or something. Not that I'm comparing myself by any means to Joe DiMaggio, but you probably know where this is going, Garrett, as a sports fan, right? He said something like, you know, every time I get up to bat, there's 60,000 people in the stadium watching, and it could be a kid watching for the first time. It's not exactly the same thing, but I mean, every time I'm on CNN, you know, even if it's our least watched hours, there's way more than 60,000 people watching, and you need to deliver. So I work hard at it, but it's easy to work hard if you care and if you love the work. And, you know, it was not planned. It was just a stroke of fortune, a strike of lightning. And I've ridden it for 7 years now, and I'm grateful for it.
Yeah, that's wonderful, Ellie. I really appreciate you sharing all that. And I'm glad you brought up Joe DiMaggio. You know, Michael Jordan and the late Kobe Bryant said the same thing, that there could be somebody, you know, in the stands watching me play. So I have to be on it, you know, 110%. I mean, that's really what their mentality was.
And similar to what they said, you know, there's days when it's like, okay, I've been on 5 times today and now they need me to do one more hit at 11:15 p.m. And it's like, trust me, there's a temptation to be like, I'm tired, it's late, you know, and just like, I don't know, let me just sort of get through this one. But you can't. You just, you know, even in our least watched times, there's hundreds of thousands of people watching. And it's your professional reputation at stake. Each time, you know, look, we're live. I mean, other than Saturday Night Live and sports, there's nothing else on TV that's live. So you're on a wire. You're on a high wire every day. I mean, you get used to it, and sometimes, you know, you can embrace it and use it to your advantage. But man, if you go in there not prepped, it's going to show. And I've seen people do that. So yeah, you can't take it for granted.
Well, every time you speak on CNN, you never miss a beat. You're very clear, concise. I mean, you explain it very well. I mean, you're very detailed, but you explain in a way that's very comprehensive. So does it matter who might be listening? You know, someone who is in your profession, another legal scholar, someone who may not have a law degree and they're a layperson who might not understand the inner workings of how the law works, but you break it down for everybody. So,
well, the key is to explain without dumbing down, right? One thing I always think about is like, who is your target audience? Like, who do you imagine yourself speaking to? And I imagine sort of one of two. I imagine like my mom's friends who are, you know, suburban women, smart, not necessarily lawyers or whatever. And I teach college undergrads who are very interested and excited about this stuff. But also, again, none of them have been to law school or anything like that. So I sort of, in fact, teaching them is actually good practice and good reps for being on TV and vice versa. So that's sort of how you think about it. You know, it's funny because I just recorded the audiobook for the new book and it took, you know, the better part of a week. And my editor gave me really good advice. He said, you're not reading your book, you're telling the story that's in the book. And think about some specific person who you're telling your story to. I found that to be really helpful.
Yeah, that's great advice. Absolutely wonderful advice. And it's nice to hear, it's refreshing to hear that you teach at the undergraduate level at Rutgers, where you went undergrad. And it must mean a lot to you knowing that you're not only teaching and informing, but you're mentoring. I mean, did your students come up to you and say,
it's the best thing ever. Yeah. I mean, look, I, you know, these kids become like my kids. I have a couple of my actual own, but you know, I've been teaching now, it's been 5, 6 years. And I have students who have gone not only to, I write a million, this is the time of year, I have like law school letters. You know, you can't even believe how many I get asked to write. I tell the students, don't be shy. I'm happy to write them for you. Come on in. But I have students who are in law school now. I have students who have gone through law school and are now prosecutors and working at the FBI and working at DOJ and working at big law firms. And they, not all, but a lot of them stay in touch. There is nothing better than getting that email or that DM or that text from someone who just, one of my students just got hired at the Manhattan DA. A couple of my students just got internships at the governor's office. One of my students just got into Harvard Law. I mean, another student just got a scholarship to, gosh, one of the, I want to say Vanderbilt or something like that. You know, it's just, there's nothing better than that. And it's funny because when people hear that I teach, they go, oh, law school? I go, no, undergrads. But it's great because you're shaping these kids forever. You know, they're going to remember this experience and take it with them. I mean, a lot of them have written about that and talked to me about that. So it's the best.
Yeah, that's incredible. And I was born in Hackensack, New Jersey. My parents went to Fairleigh Dickinson University in Teaneck. My dad grew up in Fort Lee, New Jersey. My mom grew up in the Bronx. And then my parents actually met for the first time their senior year in high school. They married about over a decade later. And then I lived in New Jersey for 4 years, but then we moved to Florida, grew up in Florida. But I've lived in DC, Atlanta, Charlotte, all of North Carolina, because I went to school at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, lived in Bristol, Connecticut. But my time in Washington, DC, living in DC, interning for a US congressman from North Carolina, I mentioned I worked at ESPN, NBC Universal, but I have a lot of contacts in DC. People have worked at the State Department, people who have worked at the White House, people have worked at the Pentagon, and there's something magical about DC. I know sometimes it gets a bad rap just with all the polarized nature of the city and just the political division, the divisiveness that our country is going through, but I hope we see better days ahead, you know, for our country.
Yeah, I mean, I love DC as well. I don't know what the fear. I mean, look, Donald Trump, I think we can agree, is a uniquely polarizing figure in that the people who love him, and the people who hate him, hate him. And it can be hard. And one of the things I do on air that I think surprises people in a good way is, like, I'm not ideologically driven or predictable. And I would love to see more people who love and support Donald Trump be willing to say, I support the guy, but I think he's wrong on this. And vice versa, I'd like to see some of the people who hate him be able to say, you know, he's got a point on that, or he's may have a good approach on something or other. And it can't be that whether it's Donald Trump or Joe Biden, let's just take the last two, can possibly be right on everything or wrong on everything. And the people I really look up to in media are those people who have been straight shooters and don't play politics. I'm talking about someone like John King at CNN, Michael Smirkanish, Dan Abrams, you know, people who, Jake Tapper, you know, who are unafraid to call it out no matter who's doing it and are not ideologically driven. There's many more, but those are the first few that popped into my mind.
Yes, absolutely. And I've been interviewed on cable network television myself, local news, digital news platforms. I actually was featured on Michael Smirkanish's CNN show. I'll have to send you the link, but he read my tweet last year on one of his segments, and my tweet had to do with, you know, based upon like the evolutionary track of the Democratic and Republican parties, how much will the parties evolve after the 2024 election? And Michael wasn't sure if the Democratic Party would evolve just as much as the Republican Party. Yeah. And I'll have to send you the link offline.
Yeah, I've been on his show and I've told him we can do tweets. I can respond on the spot. You know, I fill in for him on radio. So you get good, and Dan Abrams, you get good reps just talking to normal people. I mean, I filled in for Dan yesterday and it was an hour's worth of phone calls from real people in North Carolina, in Wyoming, in Ohio. You know, when you live in New York and DC and work in those places, it's like you are in a bubble. And it can really be helpful to hear from normal humans out there. And so I like that part. It's always a fun part of the show because Michael is like, bring it on. He doesn't know what's coming. He tells his producer, you show me good provocative tweets. And sometimes Michael gets mad, right? You've seen him go, no, that's BS. You're wrong. And sometimes he agrees and says, that's a good point. So, yeah.
And that's awesome that you get to, you know, be a part of his show, you know, as a contributor or like actually getting to speak with people. You know, he felt that the MAGA movement would outlast Trump, where some people thought it would. I mean, do you believe?
Yeah, I don't know.
What do you think?
I don't know. So I'm always comfortable saying, no, I don't think anybody knows. Well, I do think that there is a Trump specific element to it. Like, it doesn't work. There's a cult of personality around Trump. It won't necessarily translate to the next guy, whether it's J.D. Vance or whoever else. But I do think a lot of the values and approaches Trump has taken, people will emulate. And people, you know, to some extent, you see Democrats saying we need to be more Trumpy, not on the policy, but we need to be more plain spoken. We need to shoot from the hip and be more instinctive in what we do rather than so pre-planned. You know, that's in fact a very common. They won't say we want to be like Trump, but that's what they're really saying. When you see Gavin Newsom, you know, cursing and being all uninhibited or trying to act like he's uninhibited, there's really a movement towards the Trumpian approach to politics. So I think, look, the guy, like it or not, he's the most influential political figure in the United States of the 21st century. I mean, by far, influential can be for, doesn't necessarily mean good or bad. And maybe dating back a long time before that, who has changed our politics, again, for better and worse, more than Donald Trump? So I you know, what happens next? I'll tell you this. We haven't known when the Trump endpoint would be. It's always been the, can he survive? Can he win in 2016? Okay, he won in 2016. Can he win in 2020? Will he come back? Will the cases fall, you know, befall him or not? Now we know. Like January 2029, he will be done. And you know, he's not running for a third term. That's crazy talk. It's crazy to even, he's not serious about that. So where do we go from there? Who takes over? What type of politics prevails? I have no idea.
What would you say that Barack Obama was influential in the positive sense, where Donald Trump has been influential in the negative sense? And they're like two of our presidents in the 21st century, but they're seen as polar opposites.
Well, they're like, very different. They're very different. And they're certainly the two most influential, I think, figures of the 21st century. I guess you could argue which is more. I think Barack Obama did a better job at being president than Donald Trump. I think Barack Obama was much more faithful to our traditional norms, values, laws, whereas Trump does whatever he wants in his own way. But it's not just as simple as like all good, all bad. But look, I think Barack Obama had an exemplary run as president. And I think he's going to be hard to equal. You know, I'm not saying he's unparalleled or, you know, I'm not saying he's the greatest president in history. But in terms of recent presidents, I think he had a remarkable run. And what, by the way, in the book, there's really no, it's almost like a gap in the Obama years. There's, you know, there's scandals before and after. The closest thing we can get to, well, it's an important chapter in the book, is the Hillary Clinton email investigation, which really had nothing to do with Obama, but it was horribly mishandled by DOJ, by Loretta Lynch, and by Jim Comey. And I'm very critical of the way, especially Jim Comey handled that. That's not really, has nothing to do with Obama. But I was, it's funny because I was saying to David Axelrod, who I'm friends with, you know, I had dinner with him the other night, and I said, you guys, you're not mentioned in this book. Obama's barely mentioned in this book. Nothing scandal. Like, you guys were really, I mean, they weren't 100% scandal free, but they were pretty damn close. And when you compare it to certainly Trump, Biden, Clinton, the Reagan Bush era had Iran-Contra, Carter was pretty scandal free. And then Nixon, you know, Obama really sort of, Obama, I guess, and Carter were the two that were the least scandal plagued.
It seems to me that, and Democratic Party's not perfect, but it seems to me like Republican administrations have had, you know, more controversy, perhaps from a public policy perspective. I mean, you think about Watergate with Nixon, Reagan had his issues, and the Bush years. I mean, when you think of just what led up to the Great Recession, mismanaging Hurricane Katrina, I mean, there are other things, deregulating Wall Street, if you will. I mean, you can think of some other examples. Yeah. And then you have the Trump years. I believe that the Democratic Party is seen as more of the higher morals and ethics. But again, I'm not trying in any way, shape, or form disparaging the Republican Party and saying
sign on to the morals and ethics part. But let me talk about, with respect to the book, I mean, if you were to try to quantify or do a scorecard of which party's been engaged, had more scandals in it, I think, you know, going back to Watergate, I think Republicans have had more. I mean, just like numerically, objectively. I mean, Nixon and Trump, if you had to rank the scandalousness of the administrations, it would probably go Nixon and Trump, followed by Clinton, probably followed by Biden, and then George W. Bush, and then, you know, Obama and Carter at close to zero. So, Yeah, I mean, I think objectively, Republicans have had more scandal and criminal scandal and criminal adjacent scandal than Democrats.
And does it bother you? Because it bothers me that, you know, throughout the years that we as a human race live on Earth, like to the end of time, that in history books, you know, whether or not, and you pointed to Alvin Bragg's case in the beginning, that Alvin Bragg, by, you know, presiding over that case and Trump being convicted with 34 felony counts, that he is the only U.S. president to date who has been a convicted felon serving in this office. And whether or not, you know, Class C felonies, low-level felonies, felonies nonetheless, but given how polarizing all four cases were, especially that one, but that was the only one that was able to get to a conclusion, it just, to me, it just sets a bad precedent that years in the future, because, you know, the Supreme Court did give Donald Trump presidential immunity or degree of presidential immunity. Mm-hmm. I hope that Republicans and Democrats in the future, no matter who's in office, you know, that we can get back to the societal norms or like the typical, you know, procedures of what a president should be when it comes to integrity and character and, well, being fit to serve in office.
I agree. We want presidents who have all those things. But look, I have serious criticisms of Alvin Bragg's prosecution. I do think it was politically motivated. I don't think he would have charged anyone else. No other human being in history has been charged with a federal campaign finance crime in state court. Various prosecutors passed on that case before Alvin took it. I don't think the conviction is going to hold up in appeals court. And I think one of the lessons, and I argue this in the book, is goes back to the title. When you come at the king, you best not miss. And I think Alvin missed, even though he got a conviction. I think he missed. I think the conviction is going to be thrown out. I don't really talk about Alvin's case in the book because it's focused on DOJ and federal cases. But I think the case is going to get thrown out. B, every conservative, every Trump supporter, most moderates, and even some liberals agree that the way Bragg put this case together is unconstitutional. And I think one of the lessons is prosecutors need to respect their boundaries. And that when you start pursuing somebody because of who they are, or because you're trying to damage them politically, you're going down a dangerous path, not only for them, but for you and your party as well.
Yes. And, you know, with President Biden and how those 4 years, you know, led to Donald Trump getting back into the White House, how much do you put attention to, or how much time do you focus on whether or not President Biden was, you know, to many who don't support him, that he was not capable of, you know, serving in office? In my opinion, I believe that he obviously got older, you know, perhaps cognitively he's not as sharp as, let's say, if he was a younger man, but it was a big distraction, if you will. And will there be any, you know, legality or any issues, you know, going forward? Because I know that, yeah, you know, there are people in the Biden administration who are testifying because Republicans want them to talk about, was there some type of cover up? But, you know, is there any merit to that?
Well, I don't think there's any criminality here, but I read Jake Tapper and Alex Thompson's book, and I think it makes a case beyond dispute that he was not fit to do another 4 years, let's say that, and that there were conscious efforts to, yes, cover up some of his deficiencies. I don't think he was incompetent to the point where, like, the 25th Amendment would have kicked in during his first term. I think he was getting towards that at the very end, and I think it will go down as a historical disgrace that he and others tried to tell us all that he was capable. Can you imagine Joe Biden serving now, that this Joe Biden until 2029? There's no way. And, you know, Jake and Alex's book goes into the what and the why and the how of it. But look, I think Democrats ought to be furious at Joe Biden. And I don't understand Democrats who are like, you can't criticize anything that our leaders have ever done. Like, to make a sports analogy, what I've said to friends is, if you were a fan, a diehard fan of a football team that went 4-13 and just got their butts kicked, and, you know, would your position be nobody's allowed to question our head coach or our GM? Or would your position be, we might need to fix who's running this team and how they're running it, right? I mean, of course it would be the latter. And so there was this defensiveness around Joe Biden that I think contributed to this, like, effort to paint him as competent. I don't buy into these auto pen theories and he wasn't running the White House. I think he was competent enough to get by in the latter stages of his term. But I think the fact that he and his handlers tried to tell us that he was fully competent to do another 4 years is preposterous, and I think has been soundly disproven.
And just feeling that pressure, probably the White House press secretary and just the communications team, feeling that pressure from right-wing media just pounding them every day. And you and I have never worked in the White House, but just understanding what pressure there might have been felt in there to make sure that there weren't any distractions and trying to just put their best foot forward every day. Last question before we depart from interview. What does family mean to you? You say you have a couple of kids and you're happily married. So what is the nucleus of your family? What does that mean to you from a relationship building perspective, and how much that has helped you, you know, in life?
We have a very tight knit family. I grew up in South Jersey. My mom and dad still together, live in the same house. I'm the oldest of three boys and still close with both my brothers. I now have, you know, I've been married 21 years, I guess. I have a 20-year-old son, an 18-year-old daughter, both going off to college. Two nieces, two nephews, the whole thing. And I mean, you know, what can I say about family that hasn't been said? I mean, that's what it's about. So very grateful for all of them.
That's wonderful. And yes, I've been happily married to my wife almost 5 years. December 12th will be our fifth wedding anniversary. We have a 2.5-year-old son who'll be 3 in November. And then my wife is 9 weeks pregnant. So we have another one on the way.
Congratulations. How great. What do you have, boy or girl, so far?
We have our 2.5-year-old son. We'll find out the gender of the child on the way in the next few weeks. We could find out at 12 weeks.
Either way, the great thing about those finding out gender, we found out both in advance, is you can't lose. You know, no matter which, you're thrilled. So,
yeah. That's awesome. Congratulations. That's awesome. Well, thank you so much, Ellie, you know, for being with me today on the Wave Capital's guest speaker series. You're very welcome. I hope you have a wonderful rest of your day and take care. And I look forward to our episode airing soon.
Thanks, Garrett. I appreciate it. Thanks for your time. Good talking to you.
Yes. Excellent talking to you as well.
Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.